Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 6th, 2021, Monday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Senate Stalwart, Bob Dole Dies, written by John Hanna and Calvin Woodward of the Associated Press. Illegal Activity is Rising, written by Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. Both Sides Plan for Battles at State Level, written by Ashraf Khalil of the AP, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Senate Stalwart, Bob Dole Dies, by John Hanna and Calvin Woodward of the AP. Bob Dole, who overcame disabling war wounds to become a sharp-tongued Senate leader from Kansas, a Republican presidential candidate, and then a symbol and celebrant of his dwindling generation of World War II veterans, died Sunday. He was 98. His wife, Elizabeth Dole, said in an announcement posted on social media that he died in his sleep. Dole announced in February that he'd been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. During his 36-year career on Capitol Hill, Dole became one of the most influential legislators and party leaders in the Senate, combining a talent for compromise with a caustic wit, which he often turned on himself, but didn't hesitate to turn on others too. He shaped tax policy, foreign policy, farm and nutrition programs, and rights for the disabled, enshrining protections against discrimination in employment, education, and public services in the Americans with Disabilities Act. Today's accessible government offices and national parks, sidewalk ramps, and the sign language interpreters at official local events are just some of the more visible hallmarks of his legacy and that of the fellow lawmakers he rounded up for that sweeping civil rights legislation 30 years ago. Dole divided his later years to the cause of wounded veterans, their fallen comrades at Arlington National Cemetery, and remembrance of the fading generation of World War II vets. Thousands of old soldiers massed on the National Mall in 2004 for what Dole, speaking at the dedication of the World War II memorial there, called our final reunion. He'd been a driving force in its creation. Our ranks have dwindled, he said then, yet if we gather in the twilight, it is brightened by the knowledge that we have kept faith with our comrades. Long gone from Kansas, Dole made his life in the Capitol at the center of power, and then in its shadow upon his retirement, living all the while at the storied Watergate complex. When he left politics and joined a law firm staffed by prominent Democrats, he joked that he brought his dog to work so he would have another Republican to talk to. He tried three times to become president. The last was in 1996 when he won the Republican nomination, only to see President Bill Clinton reelected. He sought his party's presidential nomination in 1980 and 1988 and was the 1976 GOP vice presidential candidate on the losing ticket with President Gerald Ford. Through all of that, he carried the mark of war. Charging a German position in northern Italy in 1945, Dole was hit by a shell fragment that crushed two vertebrae and paralyzed his arms and legs. The young Army platoon leader spent 3 years recovering in a hospital and never regained use of his right hand. To avoid embarrassing those trying to shake his right hand, Dole always clutched a pen in it and reached out with his left. Dole could be merciless with his rivals, whether Democrat or Republican. When George H.W. Bush defeated him in the 1988 New Hampshire Republican primary, Dole snapped, "Stop lying about my record." If that pales next to the scorching insults in today's political arena, it was shocking at the time. But when Bush died in December 2018, old rivalries were forgotten as Dole appeared before Bush's casket in the Capitol Rotunda. As an aide lifted him from his wheelchair, Dole slowly steadied himself and saluted his one-time nemesis with his left hand, his chin quivering. In a vice presidential debate 2 decades earlier with Walter Mondale, Dole had famously and audaciously branded all of America's wars that century Democrat wars. Mondale shot back that Dole had just richly earned his reputation as a hatchet man. Dole at first denied saying what he had just said on that public stage, then backed down and eventually acknowledged he'd gone too far. "I was supposed to go for the jugular," he said, "and I did. My own." For all of his bare-knuckled ways, he was a deep believer in the Senate as an institution and commanded respect and even affection from among Democrats. Just days after Dole announced his dire cancer diagnosis, President Joe Biden visited him at his home to wish him well. The White House said the two were close friends from their days in the Senate. Biden recalled in a statement Sunday that one of his first meetings outside the White House after being sworn in as president was with the Doles at their Washington home. "Like all true friendships, regardless of how much time has passed, we picked up right where we left off as though it were only yesterday that we were sharing a laugh in the Senate dining room or debating the great issues of the day, often against each other on the Senate floor," Biden said. "I saw in his eyes the same light, bravery, and determination I've seen so many times before." Biden ordered that U.S. flags be flown at half-staff at the White House and all public buildings and grounds until sunset Thursday. Dole won a seat in Congress in 1960, representing a western Kansas House district. He moved up to the Senate 8 years later when Republican incumbent Frank Carlson retired. There, he antagonized his Senate colleagues with fiercely partisan and sarcastic rhetoric delivered at the behest of President Richard Nixon. The Kansan was rewarded for his loyalty with the chairmanship of the Republican National Committee in 1971, before Nixon's presidency collapsed in the Watergate scandal. He served as a committee chairman, majority leader, and minority leader in the Senate during the 1980s and 90s. Altogether, he was the Republicans' leader in the Senate for nearly 11 and a half years, a record until Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell broke it in 2018. During this period, he earned a reputation as a shrewd, pragmatic legislator, tireless in fashioning compromises. After Republicans won Senate control, Dole became chairman of the Tax Writing Finance Committee and won acclaim from deficit hawks and others for his handling of a 1982 tax bill in which he persuaded Ronald Reagan's White House to go along with increasing revenues by $100 billion to ease the federal budget deficit. "When Bob asked you to do something, that was it. I can tell you so many things we were able to solve by invoking Bob's name," said former GOP Senator Pat Roberts, who served alongside Dole in Kansas's congressional delegation. But some more conservative Republicans were appalled that Dole had pushed for higher taxes. Georgia Representative Newt Gingrich branded him the tax collector for the welfare state. Dole became Senate leader in 1985 and served as either majority or minority leader, depending on which party was in charge, until he resigned in 1996 to devote himself to pursuit of the presidency. That campaign, Dole's last, was fraught with problems from the start. He ran out of money in the spring, and Democratic ads painted the GOP candidate and the party's divisive House Speaker Gingrich with the same brush as Republicans out to eliminate Medicare. Clinton won by a large margin. He also faced questions about his age because he was running for president at age 73, well before Biden was elected weeks before turning 78 in 2020. Relegated to private life, Dole became an elder statesman who helped Clinton get a chemical weapons treaty passed. He also tended his wife's political ambitions. Elizabeth Dole ran unsuccessfully for the Republican presidential nomination in 2000, then served a term as senator from North Carolina. Illegal activity is rising. Residents, businesses say drug use and sales are now commonplace. By Joe Rubino of the Denver Post. Just after 9 a.m. Thursday, RTD Transit Police Sergeant Andrew Cross got a call on his radio. There were reports of a man outside the Union Station bus terminal threatening to kill people. "This is a daily occurrence," Cross said as he and RTD officer Stephen Johnson made their way toward the western end of the Union Station campus. "Usually many, many times a day." The officers caught up to the man near 17th Street and Chestnut Place. RTD has on-staff mental health clinicians, but the man wasn't interested in speaking with one of them, Cross said. The officers followed him until he headed south in the direction of the 16th Street Mall off the station grounds. "It's not a crime to have a mental health problem," Cross said. "This is kind of what we end up doing. We kind of play ping-pong with them to get them off the property." RTD officials, neighborhood residents, and area business owners are in agreement. Union Station is in crisis. Open drug use, drug sales, and threatening behavior are commonplace in making Denver's main transit hub, a campus that underwent a more than $450 million upgrade less than a decade ago, unsafe for people who pass through it and work there. "I have experienced this firsthand," RTD CEO and general manager Deborah Johnson told the Denver Post. "Theirs is just blatant illegal activity and unwelcome activities from underserved individuals." Efforts are ramping up to try to stem the tide. Under Johnson's guidance, the agency has partnered with Transportation Security Administration to bring in special teams of air marshals to patrol the property. The Armed Visible Intermodal Prevention and Response, or VIPR, teams don't have authority to enforce local laws, but are intended to provide extra eyes and support backing up RTD's own officers, contracted security guards, and off-duty Denver police officers working second jobs. "The teams will be deployed around the station at least through the end of the year," Johnson said. RTD and TSA officials declined to say how many of the agents are committed to the effort, but a memo sent out by Johnson in November said the teams will consist of 3 to 7 members paired with an RTD officer. "The teams are federally funded," officials said, a plus for the cash-strapped transit agency. RTD is also looking to boost the security presence around the station by bringing in the Guardian Angels, the red-clad volunteer group dedicated to providing extra eyes for public safety. The group was set to start patrolling Union Station and RTD's free mall ride shuttle, Johnson said Wednesday. "RTD wants to ensure that our customers, the general public, and our employees can enjoy clean and safe environments," Johnson said. The Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1001, which represents about 2,300 RTD drivers, light rail operators, mechanics, and other employees, issued a bulletin last week highlighting members' rights to refuse unsafe work. Angie Rivera-Malpiet, RTD's board chair and the elected director of the district that includes Union Station, said curtailing the public drug use and other safety concerns on the campus is an urgent problem. "It doesn't just impact her district, but RTD's entire network in the metro area at large. This is a great opportunity for the community to come together to address some real issues to support our most vulnerable population and at the same time provide safety and security at the hub of our community," she said. Shortly after interacting with the man reported for making threats near the light rail platform Thursday morning, Sergeant Cross and Officer Johnson headed downstairs into the Union Station's underground bus terminal. They approached two men sitting on the floor, one appearing to be asleep. Between the two sat a burnt piece of foil and a lighter, evidence of recent drug use. "You're sitting there using narcotics," Cross said, as the two men rose to their feet and gathered their things to leave. "You can't do that inside." Down the hall in the public restroom, Johnson caught three men in one stall trying to smoke an unknown substance off of a piece of foil. Johnson has been part of the RTD police for a few years, but he said things have never been this bad at Union Station. He's preparing for a long winter. "Cold weather will drive people down into the bus terminal and things will get worse," he said. Outside the restroom, Robert Lamer of Kearney, Nebraska, shook his head. The 37-year-old was stopping over in Denver before boarding a bus to visit relatives in Kansas, he said. Just after his arrival, he was approached by men who offered to sell him drugs. "It's like a zoo, honestly. It seems like they do anything they want," Lamer said. "It honestly doesn't look like it would be a bad little bus station if it weren't for all that." Calls for emergency services in the underground bus terminal rose more than 96% in October over September, according to Bob Grado, chief of the RTD Transit Police. There were 971 incidents in October, up from 495 the month prior. There were 872 calls for service in the bus concourse in September and October 2020 combined, according to Grado. Drug activity was far and away the leading reason for emergency calls this fall. The chief doesn't think it's a coincidence Union Station has seen an increased presence of people experiencing homeless and more public drug use since the city of Denver shut down Civic Center Park in September. While his focus is on RTD property, he knows it's bigger than just Union Station. The downtown area is a gathering place for folks with addiction and unhoused people with mental illness, sometimes exacerbated by drugs and intoxication, Grado said. But what we're experiencing right now, I've never seen anything like it. RTD is a victim, just like the businesses downtown and the people who live there. They need more resources. Bringing in TSA teams is a step in the right direction because the RTD police force is small, only about 20 officers when excluding secondary employment officers from Denver and Aurora, Grado said. The department is working to grow its ranks, but recruitment in Colorado is tough. Compounding challenges for RTD officers, Grado said, is that the state legislature downgraded possession of small amounts of drugs from felonies to misdemeanors, and the Denver Department of Public Safety has not granted the department authority to issue tickets for drug-related offenses. The depth of the problem has the chief thinking of other possible solutions. He noted that New York City has just opened supervised injection sites in Manhattan. Some people are using us for safe injection sites because we're there to rescue them in the event of an overdose, Grado said. The city safety department is discussing options around what can be done to support RTD police and allow them to safely respond to calls, spokeswoman Kelly Jacobs said in an email Friday. Jacobs' email arrived shortly after Mayor Michael Hancock put out a statement on social media announcing he had sent his chief of staff and public safety director Murphy Robinson to meet with RTD and union officials about the conditions at the station. Denver police will be taking more active role there, according to the mayor. To commence immediately, Police Chief Paul Pazin will increase police presence around Union Station to augment RTD in its efforts to address illegal and unsafe behaviors within the terminal, Hancock said in the statement. Denver City Councilwoman Candy Sidabaca, whose district includes Union Station, said she was in the area on Thanksgiving passing out meals to homeless people. People were hard to find on the station campus that day, Sidabaca said, but she did see the trailer that RTD police are using, a mobile command center parked outside. The trailer is another visible tool the department hopes will deter drug use and other activity there. Sidabaca said that she hadn't heard anything about RTD's plans to bring in TSA teams and the Guardian Angels until a Denver Post reporter contacted her. I don't currently know how to feel about it, Sidabaca said. I'm frustrated that we weren't contacted. I am unclear on what these entities are going to be able to do and how they are going to engage with neighbors. One group of neighbors is already expressing optimism about RTD efforts to step up visible enforcement. The Lower Downtown Neighborhood Association's Safe, Clean, and Compassionate Committee, formed as an outgrowth of the concerns of people living in the Coloradan condos and other buildings around Union Station, founding member Billy Kurtz said. The group's aim is to work with RTD, the Downtown Denver Partnership, business owners, and other groups to put pressure on elected officials to do more about problems around the station. According to a change.org petition launched by Kurtz, that includes providing more resources for those who are homeless, empowering police to enforce the law, and reinstating pre-pandemic policies and procedures at the Denver jail regarding inmate retention. The goal, Kurtz said, is to restore Union Station to the gleaming public gathering place it was when it was first reopened in 2014. A perfect storm has taken place to make it not a clean and safe place right now, Kurtz said. We want to do something about it, and we believe we can. The Union Station campus is more than a transit hub. The historic station building is also home to retailers, restaurants, and the Crawford Hotel. The Great Hall space is privately leased and operated, utilizing its own security. When contacted about the issues on the campus, Sage Hospitality Group, the company that operates the hotel, wrote in an emailed statement, "We support the ongoing efforts of the Denver Police Department and RTD, who manage the security of the public transit areas and outdoor plazas." Other business owners have been more pointed in the criticism of the state of the area. Fast casual Asian food chain Teriyaki Madness shut down its location across from the station in June. CEO Michael Haith later told Business Den the homeless issue down in that area was unsafe. We had a terrible time operating the restaurant, and we didn't see any end in sight. I will not mince words. Eva Doyle walked her dog Gus along Wawata Street on Thursday morning, something she does four times a day. The 28-year-old lives in the apartment building atop the Whole Foods Market store there. It's just tough. I feel torn. There is such a huge problem with people experiencing homelessness. They need more resources, Doyle said of the conditions in her neighborhood. But I'm a young woman who goes out at night with a dog, so it is a little bit alarming. She pointed to the fencing surrounding the garden area in the middle of the block, something put in place by the Central Platte Valley Metropolitan District in part to deter drug use, officials say. It's just a bummer if you're just trying to enjoy the area, Doyle said. She plans to move out of the neighborhood when her lease is up. After Cross and Johnson cleared the bathroom in the bus terminal Thursday morning, they went up a stairwell and out onto Chestnut Street side of the property, sending a group of men gathered there scattering. Hey, I told them to pick up their garbage, River Walker, 20, said to the officers, stooping over to pick some up himself. Walker said he used to be homeless and a drug user, but has since found a job at a fast food restaurant and place to live in East Denver. He visits Union Station regularly to check in with friends still tapped in the hellhole of this lifestyle and provide food and hygiene products when he can. On Thursday, he was handing out ice cream bars. I may only be getting paid minimum wage, but I'm saving a lot of money, not spending it on drugs, he said. Walker lost his father to a heroin overdose. He hopes people are compassionate when they see others living on the streets struggling with addiction. We're all just people, Walker said. They're not hurting anybody but themselves, you know? Both sides plan for battles at state level. By Ashraf Khalil of the AP. As the Supreme Court weighs the future of the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, a resurgent anti-abortion movement is looking to press its advantage in state-by-state battles, while abortion rights supporters prepare to play defense. Both sides seem to be operating on the assumption that a court reshaped by former President Donald Trump will either overturn or seriously weaken Roe. We have a storm to weather, said Elizabeth Nash, state policy analyst for the Guttmacher Institute, a research organization that supports abortion rights. We have to weather the storm so that in the future, 5, 10, 15 years from now, we're talking about how we manage to repeal all these abortion bans. The Institute estimates that as many as 26 states would institute some sort of abortion access restrictions within a year, if permitted by the court. At least 12 states have trigger bans on the books with restrictions that would kick in automatically if the justices overturn or weaken federal protections on abortion access. The current case before the court, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, concerns a Mississippi law that bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Roe versus Wade, which was reaffirmed in a subsequent 1992 ruling in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, allows states to regulate but not ban abortion up until the point of fetal viability at roughly 24 weeks. The fate of the Mississippi case won't be known for months, but based on opening arguments, Roe appears to be in peril. All six of the court's conservative justices, including Trump appointees Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett, indicated they would uphold the Mississippi law. There's no doubt that what we heard from the Supreme Court was incredibly disturbing, said Ianth Metzger, director of state media campaigns for the Planned Parenthood Action Fund, one of the most prominent advocates of abortion access rights. It wasn't really surprising, but it was alarming. Susan Arnold, director of outreach for the Anti-Abortion Right to Life League, said she was encouraged by Justice Samuel Alito's emphasis on the concept of viability for the fetus as a guiding principle on when to ban the termination of a pregnancy. She predicts that modern advancements in medicine will continue to shrink the window in which a fetus is not viable, opening the door to a host of medically intricate state-level debates. Viability is something that is subject to medical science, Arnold said. It's going to get intensely legal and intensely medical. Both sides seem to have been preparing for this moment for years, particularly with Trump having installed more than 200 federal judges and three Supreme Court justices during his presidency. Pro-abortion access groups donated $8 million in 2018 and more than $10 million in 2020, according to Open Secrets, a nonpartisan group that tracks political spending. Those numbers outpace the public contributions of anti-abortion groups, which donated $2.6 million in 2018 and $6.3 million in 2020, according to Open Secrets. But the complexity of the network of nonprofits and dark money funds makes it difficult to produce a full accounting of the money flows. While Washington is the primary current battleground, many leaders of the conservative movement are treating the judicial battle as won and Roe's demise as an inevitability. The next battleground will be shifting cat-and-mouse fight in state legislatures and in next year's elections across the country. People are realizing that 7 months from now, we'll probably be dealing with this on a state level, said Brian Birch, president of Catholic Vote. This will become much more prominent in state electoral races, especially governor's races. Legislatures in many Republican-led states are poised for action, depending on the Supreme Court's ruling. On Wednesday, the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals vacated previous rulings that had blocked a Tennessee law that included banning abortions once a fetal heartbeat is detected, about 6 weeks, and ordered a rehearing by the full court. The battle has been happening in the state houses for decades, and it's going to intensify, Nash said. The Supreme Court's ruling is expected around June, almost guaranteeing that the issue will dominate next fall's congressional elections, as well as state-level races from coast to coast. Penalties less likely for hospitals. Some in Colorado are punished over patients coming back too soon, by Meg Wingerter. Colorado hospitals were less likely to be hit by Medicare penalties for having too many patients boomerang back than were all U.S. facilities, though close to one in three will still get less money from the federal government next year. The penalties, which have been levied for 8 years, deduct a certain percentage from the payments a hospital receives from Medicare if their patients are more likely than average to need hospital care again quickly. In 2022, 31 of the state's 94 hospitals, or about 62% of Colorado's facilities that are eligible for a penalty, will take one. Nationwide, about 80% will, said Aiken Demahin, director of policy at the American Hospital Association. Hospitals are exempt if they are critical access facilities, meaning the only hospital serving a rural area, serve a specialized population, such as children or people receiving psychiatric treatment, or treated fewer than 25 people for certain illnesses. A few factors influence why more hospitals in some states would be penalized, Demahin said. Some hospitals attract patients with more complex needs, and some are in areas where patients don't have easy access to primary care doctors for follow-up appointments, pharmacies to refill their medications, or grocery stores to buy healthy foods, he said. Readmissions certainly have to do with the care you get in the hospital, but they also have to do with the resources in the community, he said. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services calculate the expected number of readmissions for a hospital attempting to control for how sick patients may be. They then determine how large the gap is between the expected readmissions and the number of people actually returning in 30 days. Hospitals are then compared to others that serve a similar percentage of people who are eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid, a particularly complicated group because the vast majority are over 65 and have serious health problems. Those with bigger gaps compared to their peer groups are penalized. The higher a hospital's readmissions are compared to their group, the higher the penalty on their payments from Medicare, with a maximum deduction of 3%. None of the Colorado hospitals will take the maximum hit, and the median penalty in the state is 0.18%, meaning half will lose more than 2022 and half less. The idea behind the penalties is to push hospitals to do more to stop patients from coming back with avoidable complications. That could mean having someone assigned to help set follow-up appointments or talking about resources if they can't afford medications or healthy food to manage their chronic conditions. Of course, not all rehospitalizations are avoidable, and would be dangerous to tell patients to just not come back if they develop complications. The penalties are based on how many patients unexpectedly returned in 30 days after being treated for a heart attack, heart failure, pneumonia, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a knee or hip replacement, or coronary artery bypass graft surgery. Planned readmissions, such as having a heart attack patient come back for surgery after they've recovered at home for a few days, don't count against the hospital. Readmission penalties are extremely common. Only three Colorado hospitals that aren't exempt haven't been dinged at some point: Mercy Regional Medical Center in Durango, Community Hospital in Grand Junction, and Ortho Colorado Hospital in Lakewood. The number of hospitals penalized has increased over the years as CMS expanded its program from three conditions to seven. That meant more facilities were eligible based on at least one measure. The information used to calculate the penalties was collected before COVID-19 reached the United States, so that won't be a factor. CMS is going to remove the first months of 2020 from future calculations, won't penalize hospitals based on pneumonia readmissions, and will try to filter out COVID-19 patients from the data it looks at. But it's still not clear if that will be enough to remove the effects of the pandemic from decisions about penalties in future years, Demahan said. It's a good place to start, he said. Readmission rates dropped modestly after the penalties kicked in, and despite fears there was no increase in all-cause mortality, suggesting hospitals weren't refusing to admit people with serious complications, according to a 2019 report from the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, which advises Congress. The program may have drawn hospitals' attention to what they could do to improve patients' odds of staying healthy in the community, but with so many being penalized, it may not be doing much to separate hospitals that are serious about improving quality from those that aren't, Demahan said. The fact that a hospital gets a readmission penalty doesn't mean they're not committed to reducing readmissions, he said. They may have made great strides. And from the series Faces of the Front Range, how do you get on or off that thing? Breckus turns heads on his penny-farthing bicycle, by Sam Tabachnik. Paul Breckus is used to the gazes, the waves, the heads tilting in wonderment, eyes bulging out of people's heads like in a cartoon, as he rides through the neighborhood on his strange, wonderful contraption. Look at that, a mother said to her daughter on one November day, grabbing the young girl's attention on a nearby park bench. Man, that looks dangerous as expletive, a teen said aloud as Breckus cruised past. A police officer gave a giant thumbs up out his cruiser window. An older woman waved enthusiastically from a bus stop outside a senior living facility. Children and adults mouthed the same phrase. What is that thing? If you live in North Denver, you probably already know Breckus, or at least have smiled and waved as he biked merrily past you, perched atop his replica of an 1885 Victor penny-farthing bicycle. It's from up there, high above traffic, pedestrians, and the rest of humanity that Breckus observes the world turn. There's an old saying, Breckus said on a warm November afternoon, the world smiles when you're on a penny farthing. It's hard not to grin when you see Breckus ease past on his vintage ride, the giant 60-inch front wheel leading the way, the 20-inch back wheel trailing obediently like a younger sibling following his older brother wherever he goes. The 67-year-old retired IT professional first got into penny farthings in 2000. Because I'm nuts, he said with a smile. It was a match made in two-wheeled heaven for the antique enthusiast who also collects phonographs and telegraph machines and runs a record-cutting business on the side. These bikes were commonplace in the late 1800s, which explains why they're called standard bikes, at least in Breckus's world. That fancy road bike sitting in your garage? That's a safety bike, Breckus said, adding that he doesn't appreciate when people call penny farthings big wheel bikes. The most common question he gets, how do you get on or off that thing? The short answer, it's a production in motion. Breckus first gets the penny farthing moving slowly, since he'd fall off if he got on like a normal bike. He pushes the bicycle from behind, moving into a slow jog, before he lifts his foot onto a small step on the back of the bike, catapulting his 6'2" frame onto the seat and into the pedals. It takes about 15 minutes to learn and roughly an hour to get comfortable riding a penny farthing, Breckus said. He's a fan of the emergency dismount, which essentially means jumping off the back of the bike like it's on fire. "It's falling with style," he said, quoting the Buzz Lightyear phrase. "The penny farthing isn't for the faint of heart, however. Breckus has gotten into two crashes, including one 20 years ago on Interstate 80 that sent him to the hospital. His two front teeth paid the price, and he still sports a scar under his mustache. Breckus, though, mostly cruises around town, disappointed if he doesn't hit 100 miles by week's end. The Berkeley resident loves the Clear Creek and Cherry Creek bike paths and often does loops around Washington Park. He's proud to say he's gone up Lookout Mountain 3 times, though the descent made him think, 'I'm gonna die.' Breckus once did 116 miles in a day trekking to and from Palmer Lake. The old school bicycle is actually pretty comfortable once you're up there. That is, until you fall," Breckus said with a grin. "But it's the smiles and reactions from people around him that give him the greatest joy. You have to check your ego often," Breckus said. "They're excited by the bike, not you." He remembers riding near the intersection of 15th and Larimer Streets in downtown Denver when a Rastafarian yelled, "Thank you for messing with my fragile sense of reality." "I almost fell off my bike," Breckus said with a laugh. On a recent ride through Sunnyside, Breckus turned heads at every intersection. He wore a Popeye the Sailor Man bike jersey and sports a white handlebar mustache, befitting a man who rides a bike popular when Grover Cleveland sat in the Oval Office. A pair of teens hopped off their scooters to take a video on the Cherry Creek Trail as Breckus ducked to avoid hitting his head on a bridge, something that has happened before, he said. A man passing on his bike muttered, "That's expletive sick." At 67, Breckus is just hoping to keep riding until he can't. "I've always joked that the way I want to go out is getting broadsided by a steam engine," he said, smiling. Fire forces evacuations near Idaho Springs. A wildfire near Idaho Springs forced evacuation Sunday, according to the Clear Creek County Sheriff's Office. The Miner's Candle Fire was estimated at 20 acres Sunday morning and burned about 5 miles west of Idaho Springs, according to the Clear Creek County Office of Emergency Management. The blaze, which was 50% contained by late Sunday afternoon, forced evacuations along Miner's Candle Road, Lamartine Road, Trail Creek Road, and Sunny Skies Trail, according to the Sheriff's Office. Evacuation orders were expected to remain in place overnight. About 20 to 25 homes were evacuated. The fire destroyed 2 structures, according to the sheriff's office. There have been no reports of injuries or fatalities. It was not immediately clear Sunday when the fire started or how. Wildfire burns in foothills near Denver. A small wildfire burned Sunday in the foothills southwest of Denver, according to West Metro Fire Rescue. The about 6-acre West Ranch fire was burning in the foothills west of the Ken Carroll Valley Sunday afternoon, the fire agency said. The closest subdivision, called West Ranch, was about a half mile from the fire, said Dan Hattelstad, battalion chief for Inner Canyon Fire Protection District. The subdivision was not threatened by the blaze early Sunday evening, and no evacuation or pre-evacuations were in place, Hattelstad said. Any such orders would go out through the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, he added. Firefighters were forced to hike into steep and rocky terrain to reach the fire, Hattelstad said. The blaze was driven by wind and was moving slowly through brush. There are isolated pockets of pines in that area, and those are at times flaring up, but within the fire perimeter, he said. Now to sports. Dirty Dozen. Denver drops 12th straight game to KC dating to 2015. Williams' big day spoiled with 2 second-half interceptions by Ryan O'Halloran. Teddy Bridgewater sat on the bench after his second interception, helmet off and using both hands to rub his temples. Imagine his thoughts after he became the latest Broncos starting quarterback to lose to Kansas City. About the first interception, which was the kind of throw veterans like him shouldn't make. About the second turnover, which was returned for a touchdown to seal the Chiefs' 22-9 win Sunday night at Arrowhead Stadium. And about the loss, which put a dent in his team's playoff hopes. It was an opportunity squandered by Bridgewater and the team's anemic offense, failing to capitalize on their defense, holding the Chiefs' offense to only 1 touchdown. The Chiefs have won 12 consecutive games over the Broncos. KC quarterback Patrick Mahomes has never lost to the Broncos. Broncos coach Vic Fangio has never beat the Chiefs. "Obviously a tough loss tonight," Bridgewater said. In this environment and against an opponent like the Chiefs, you're not going to walk away with the win committing three turnovers. Kansas City sealed the win with 9:42 remaining. On 4th and 2, linebacker Ben Neiman deflected Bridgewater's pass. Safety Daniel Sorensen collected the interception and returned it 75 yards for a touchdown and a 22-3 lead. The loss wasn't an end-all for the Broncos, who fell to 6-6, but it certainly narrows their margin for error in order to make the playoffs. Kansas City leads the division, followed by the Los Angeles Chargers. Las Vegas blew a late home lead to Washington to fall to 6-6, and the Raiders next play at the Chiefs. The Broncos must win their next two games home against Detroit, which may well be still celebrating its first win when its charter flight touches down in Denver on Saturday, and Cincinnati. The Bengals looked out of sorts against the Bolts on Sunday. We have 5 games left. They're all playoff games, and we hold our destiny in our hands, Broncos receiver Cortland Sutton said. It's a win-or-go-home mentality. The locker room understands that and is rallying around that. That the Broncos were within one possession of the Chiefs until the 5:35 mark of the third quarter was a semi-accomplishment considering how the game started. The first 10-plus minutes were a debacle for the Broncos, who didn't appear ready for the opponent or the stage. Fangio made the rare decision to take the football after winning the toss. The offense went 3 and out, and the Chiefs were off and running and passing. Kansas City moved 72 yards over 12 plays to take a 7-0 lead on Mahomes' 10-yard scramble to the corner of the end zone. The Broncos responded with a 3 and out, and the Chiefs made it 10-0 on Harrison Butker's 56-yard field goal that clanged off the left upright and fell through. At that point, the Chiefs had a 124-2 advantage in yards, and it felt like 1,124-2. But to their credit, the Broncos woke up, starting with a 36-yard catch and run by receiver Jerry Jeudy on a right-to-left over route. Armed with field position, running back Javonte Williams gained 14, and Bridgewater scrambled for 9 to set up first down at the Chiefs' 14. But penalties on Sutton, pass interference, and Bridgewater for intentional grounding made it a 2nd and 30, and Brandon McManus was good from 42 yards. After forcing a Chiefs punt, the Broncos started at their 3-yard line. The season's longest drive in terms of plays and time elapsed ended with no points when Williams was stopped for a 1-yard loss on 4th and 2 from the Kansas City 8. Linebacker Willie Gay darted inside too quickly for the right guard Quinn Meanners to make the block. You get the ball all the way down the field and you don't score. It stinks, Bridgewater said. The verdict on passing on 3 points? The right move after talking all week about how field goals won't cut it against the Chiefs in Kansas City. And really, at that point, what was the difference between being down 10-3 and 10-6? Underdogs need to be aggressive. But it was a missed opportunity, the same for early in the third quarter when Sertan corralled Mahomes' pass for his 4th interception of the year when it went through the hands of receiver Tyreek Hill. The Broncos then went 3 and out. The Chiefs took the ensuing possession into Broncos territory on running back Darrell Williams' 38-yard catch and run, but Kansas City stalled, and Butker's 45-yard field goal made it 13-3 with 5:35 left in the third quarter. Cue the Broncos unraveling. Williams converted a 3rd and 1 to reach Chiefs territory, but on the next play, Bridgewater was intercepted by safety Juan Thornhill. Bridgewater was looking for Jeudy, and it was if he didn't see Thornhill lurking underneath the route. The Broncos' breakdown spiraled on the final play of the third quarter when Caden Stearns collided with punt returner Deontay Spencer. Hello, near-weekly special teams fiasco. The Chiefs recovered at the Broncos' 16. The defense held, and Butker's 26-yard field goal extended the lead to 16-3 with 13:26 remaining. Sorensen's interception, the Broncos' 3rd second-half turnover, ended the upset hopes. Williams' 13-yard touchdown catch with 5:12 remaining cut the Chiefs' lead to 13 points, and Kansas City covered the onside kick. We just have to rebound and start this last 5-game run playing Detroit and get back on track, Fangio said. Get rid of Bridgewater and Shurmur to beat KC by Mark Kisla. All the worst nightmares happen in slow motion. Case in point, the Broncos' offense, which will make you wake in a cold sweat, pleading to the football gods to please, oh please, let this 12-game losing streak to the Chiefs end. Stop me if you've already seen this nightmare. Kansas City 22, Denver 9. A loss makes you feel empty, Coach Vic Fangio said late Sunday. The Broncos are stuck in a recurring bad dream, painted orange and blue with 50 shades of frustration, where offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur gives them all the wrong answers to the test, and quarterback Teddy Bridgewater leaves us all feeling naked and exposed at the 50-yard line of Arrowhead Stadium. Why is Shurmur still there? If a franchise icon like linebacker Von Miller can be traded, why can't Fangio hold Shurmur accountable for an inept offense and fire him? And this agonizingly inept performance by Bridgewater, who threw two costly interceptions and finished with a 62.2 quarterback rating that brought back all those bad Paxton Lynch feelings, reminding us Teddy B is just good enough to lead a team to an 8-9 record and a spot in the NFL draft, where it's very difficult to find an elite quarterback in the middle of the first round. During preparation for the biggest game played by Denver since Super Bowl 50, Bridgewater stressed the Broncos would have to be aggressive and efficient in the red zone to beat Kansas City. When you play a team like this, you have to get sevens, Bridgewater said. You have to score seven. Three isn't enough. On a night when Mahomes played like a mere mortal and the Chiefs appeared to be oh so beatable, the shortcomings of Bridgewater and Shurmur doomed Denver to defeat. Trailing 10-3 with 12 minutes, 16 seconds remaining until halftime, the Broncos took possession of the football at their own 3-yard line. The ensuing 20-play drive took longer than the last time I twiddled my thumbs while on interminable hold with my cable television provider. And it turned out to be every bit as aggravating. So here's another bullet point for Shurmur to put on his resume after Denver fires him. Shurmur became the first NFL offensive coordinator in more than 3 years to engineer a 20-play drive and come away with 0 points. Powered by running back Javonte Williams, who treats would-be tacklers like one of those inflatable Bozo Bob bags that kindergarten kids knock to the ground, the Broncos marched from the shadow of their own goal line to deep in KC territory, converting 2 fourth downs along the way. But in the red zone, a long, inspiring Denver march came to a screeching halt with head-scratching bewilderment. Needing 2 yards on 3rd down to get 1st and goal at the KC-6, Shurmur inexplicably called a pass play, which resulted in Bridgewater being so quickly flushed from the pocket that his only choice was to quickly heave a weak, incomplete pass out of bounds to avoid a sack. On 4th down, in a formation that screamed run, Williams got stuffed and the Denver offense walked off the field with 0 points after possessing the football for more than 11 minutes. Jeez, run the freaking ball, Pat. If you are in 4th down territory and require only 72 inches to move the sticks, why not pound the rock with Williams on consecutive snaps? This loss reminded me why the Broncos can't have nice things, much less to be considered a real threat to make the playoffs. Oh, there were signs this losing streak to the Chiefs can't go on forever. In his first NFL start, Williams rushed for 102 yards on 23 carries and caught 6 passes for 76 yards. Can somebody please explain to me why he hasn't been the lead back for Denver all season long? Rationalization of Melvin Gordon's hefty salary isn't an acceptable answer. The Denver defense, led by another interception by rookie cornerback Pat Surtain, limited the Chiefs to 53 snaps while holding Mahomes to 184 passing yards. But when Bridgewater threw an interception returned 75 yards by safety Daniel Sorensen for a KC touchdown in the 4th quarter, the quarterback walked to the Denver bench and held his head in his hands. Say goodbye, Mr. Shurmur, and take Teddy B with you, please. Taves puts in extra time by Mike Chambers. The Avalanche, despite having a goal against awarded and another disallowed, rallied from a 3-goal deficit to collect a point in Saturday's 6-5 overtime loss at Ottawa. Colorado, which had Sunday off in Philadelphia, is 1-1-1 on its 5-game road trip heading into Monday's game against the Flyers at Wells Fargo Center. Takeaways from Ottawa? Taser. Avs defenseman Devon Taser, Tevs, was as good, or better, as the scratched Cale Makar in running the number one power play and also leading the offense from the high slot at even strength. Taves logged a season-high 31 minutes, 17 seconds, most by an Avalanche player this season. He had two big slap shots up high that created goals, a redirection of Gabe Landeskog on the first, and scoring his own on the second to force overtime. Taves played 2 minutes and 3 seconds of Colorado's 2:07 on the power play and 2:25 of 14:17 on the penalty kill. In Toronto on Wednesday, Avs center Nathan MacKinnon said the Taves-Makar pairing is the best in the league and both should make the Canadian Olympic team if the NHL sends its players. That certainly has merit. Makar, when healthy, is the Norris Trophy frontrunner as the flashy goal scorer and end-to-end playmaker. Taves isn't as flashy but is productive and $4.9 million cheaper than Makar's $9 million cap hit. With Sam Girard in the mix and Bo Byram possibly on the cusp of returning from another concussion setback, this blue line, when healthy, is potentially awesome. Colorado already leads the league with 23 goals from defensemen. In those injuries, the Avalanche collected a point without nearly one-third of its preferred lineup. It came against an opponent with the NHL's third-worst winning percentage, but the Senators were coming off a 3-2 win at Carolina, certainly one of the league's best teams. Makar, Byram, goalie Darcy Kemper, and forward Nazem Kadri are day-to-day, coach Jared Bednar said, and forward JT Compher is joining the team here in Philly and could return against the Flyers or at the New York Rangers on Wednesday. Also, goalie Pavel Francouz is coming off a 27-save shutout for the AHL's Colorado Eagles on Saturday and a 4-0 win over Tucson. Francouz, who suffered a lower body injury in the NHL preseason, is on a conditioning stint with the Eagles. He's scheduled to be back with the Avs this week. At some point, the slew of injuries will slow, and this team will be at full force and take aim at climbing atop the Central Division standings. And Newhook. Rookie forward Alex Newhook, 20, had a highlight reel goal and an assist for his first two-point game of the season. He was also a season-best plus two. The Avs now forced to lean on youngsters in their relatively inexpensive entry-level contracts to balance the big deals given to veterans. Expect Newhook's steady production to continue and solidify bottom-six scoring. U.S. military takes action against ransomware groups, by Julian Barnes of the New York Times. The U.S. military has taken actions against ransomware groups as part of its surge against organizations launching attacks against American companies, the nation's top cyber warrior said Saturday, the first public acknowledgement of offensive measures against such organizations. General Paul M. Nakasone, head of U.S. Cyber Command and director of the National Security Agency, said that 9 months ago, the government saw ransomware attacks as the responsibility of law enforcement. But the attacks on Colonial Pipeline and JBS beef plants demonstrated that the criminal organizations behind them have been impacting our critical infrastructure, Nakasone said. In response, the government is taking a more aggressive, better coordinated approach against this threat, abandoning its previous hands-off stance. Cyber Command, the NSA, and other agencies have poured resources into gathering intelligence on the ransomware groups and sharing that better understanding across the government and with international partners. The first thing we have to do is to understand the adversary and their insights better than we've ever understood them before, Nakasone said in an interview on the sidelines of the Reagan National Defense Forum. Nakasone would not describe the actions taken by his commands, nor what ransomware groups were targeted. But he said one of the goals was to impose costs, which is the term military officials use to describe punitive cyber operations. In September, Cyber Command diverted traffic around servers being used by the Russia-based Our Evil ransomware group, officials briefed on the operation have said. The operation came after government hackers from an allied country penetrated the servers, making it more difficult for the group to collect ransoms. After our evil detected the U.S. action, it shut down, at least temporarily. Cyber Command and the NSA also assisted the FBI and the Justice Department in their efforts to seize and recover much of the cryptocurrency ransom paid by Colonial Pipeline. The Bitcoin payment was originally demanded by the Russian ransomware group known as DarkSide. Government officials have disagreed about how effective the stepped-up actions against ransomware groups have been. National Security Council officials have said activities by Russian groups have declined. The FBI has been skeptical. Some outside groups saw a lull but predicted the ransomware groups would rebrand and come back in force. Asked if the United States had gotten better at defending itself from ransomware groups, Nakasone said the country was on an upward trajectory. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Dee Hyslop.
One of the major takeaways from last month's big climate conference in Scotland is all levels of government need to collaborate to address climate change. One small New York community is trying to do just that. Hastings-on-Hudson is 20 miles north of New York City, on the banks of the Hudson River. Due to more frequent extreme weather events, Mayor Nikki Armacost says flooding has become a repeat concern. So the town has adopted a climate emergency declaration, working with Westchester County to reduce greenhouse gases. Armacost says it's critical, even for small towns, to take climate change seriously because it's increasingly becoming something they have to deal with.
Arguably, it's one of the number one concerns of municipalities, big or small, and it's a direction that we should all be moving in. It's really, really important for our children, our children's children, for future generations, that we do whatever we can to address this issue.
She says the village is now working to draft a climate action plan with a focus on sustainable transportation, and energy-efficient buildings. As the COP26 climate conference ended, the U.S. branch of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives released research on realistic pathways local governments can take to reduce per capita emissions by 63% or more by 2030 in order to meet Paris Climate Agreement goals. Angie Fife with the council says one way is through what's known as community choice aggregation, which allows governments to have a say in their local energy supplier.
That's a great way for a city to really lead by example and really demonstrate to the community that they're not only taking action themselves towards local environmental goals, but oftentimes these strategies will reduce the cost of operating city government.
She says Hastings-on-Hudson, which is powered by Sustainable Westchester, is among many New York towns that participate in community choice aggregation. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that vapes and e-cigarettes may not be as safe as you think? It is not harmless water vapor. The aerosol emitted from e-cigarettes is a mix of chemicals that may cause harm to human bodies. This includes nicotine, nanoparticles, heavy metals, and flavorings known to cause respiratory disease. It is not an FDA-approved cessation device. E-cigarettes are not approved for cessation of cigarettes at this time. Only approved nicotine products with counseling have been proven to help people quit all tobacco products for good. E-cigarettes are not regulated. At this time, there are no standard regulations for e-cigarette products. This means that the exact ingredients or how they are made are unknown. Nicotine is present in almost all products. Though some products may claim to be nicotine-free, no regulation means there is no way to show that these claims are true. Also, there are still chemicals in e-liquids that may be harmful to the human body. Nicotine is addictive. Using tobacco products has been considered a nasty habit for too long. The truth is that nicotine in tobacco products is addictive. It can change biology and, if left untreated, can last a lifetime. Nicotine can harm the developing brain. The brain is still developing until about the age of 25. Nicotine can disrupt brain development and cause impulsive behaviors and difficulty focusing. When young people use nicotine, they are susceptible to a lifetime of addiction. Flavors attract kids. Though some adults may enjoy using products flavored like cotton candy or gummy bears, many of the e-liquids are meant to taste like childhood favorites of young people. Big tobacco plays a role. Big tobacco companies who have a history of putting sales above safety own shares of many vape companies. This message was brought to you by the Tri-County Health Department. For more information, please visit tchd.org/e-cigs.
The Audio Information Network of Colorado would like to acknowledge the generous contributions of the AEC Trust. Thank you for your support. If you have questions about our many audio information services, please call us at 303-786-7777. Look us up online at aincolorado.org. Thank you for listening.